The ninth of Ab.
You start with Nisan as the first month. The ninth of Ab is obviously the ninth day of the month Ab. You'll find a little bit about this on page 264, the third volume, where Brother Russell mentions briefly in one of the quotes about the ninth of Ab. The ninth of Ab was historically a very disastrous day for Israel. If we go back to 1615 B.C., we find the Israelites having journeyed through the wilderness, come by way of Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. We find 12 spies sent out to investigate the possibility of going into the land, 10 of them bringing back a negative report. The congregation of Israel finding with those who brought back the negative report. And we find then the sentence of the Lord upon Israel, because your faith was weak, you cannot enter the promised land. You must wander for 40 more years. That sentence was pronounced in 1615 B.C. on the 9th of Ab. We go forward to 606 B.C. And this time we find the Jews inside the city of Jerusalem, the city surrounded by an alien army, the armies of Nebuchadnezzar. And finally, we find those armies breaking into the city. And after they break into the city, they burn the temple and they burn the city. And the date was the 9th of Ab. We go further down the stream of time and we come to the year 70 A.D. One more time, we find the Jews within the city walls of Jerusalem. Again, an alien and foreign army surrounding the city. And once again, because of unfaithfulness, the armies of Israel are defeated, the city is burnt, and once again the date is the 9th of Ab. In fact, on this one we'd like to read from two historians, from the Pictorial History of the Jewish People. It was on the 9th of Ab that the defenders made their final stand. They made two last-ditch sorties, but both times they were driven back. Then a Roman soldier hurled a firebrand through the golden window of the temple, and the great wooden beams inside began to burn. At the sight of the burning sanctuary, the defenders were frantic. A desperate hand-to-hand struggle followed. Rather than fall into the hands of the Romans, many chose to die in the flames. Thousands perished that day. The survivors, who were identified by informers as rebels, were promptly crucified. The flowers of the country's youth was sent to work in the Roman mines. Others were sold into slavery, including many women. This was the destruction in 9th of Ab, A.D. 70. From the book Israel and the Nations, on July 24th, the Romans captured the fortress of Antonia. 12 days later, the daily sacrifice in the temple was discontinued. On August 27th, the temple gates were burnt. 2 days later, on the anniversary of the destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians in 606 B.C., the sanctuary itself was set on fire and destroyed. By September 26, the whole city was in Titus' hands. It was razed to the ground, only three towers of Herod's palace on the western wall being left standing, with parts of the western wall itself. So again, the 9th of Ab was a very destructive day to Israel. But again, we want to go forward in history. We come to the year 135. Once again, the Jews are inside of Jerusalem. And still once again, the armies of the Romans are encompassing the city. This time under the generalship of Julius Severus. Again, the city falls. And this time, the Romans, in order to symbolize that never again will this city be occupied by Jews, they decided to build a new city, a city that was named after the emperor, called Ilia Capitolina. And the foundations of this new city were laid, if you believe it, on the 9th of Ab. Again, we'd like to quote, this time from a history of the Jews. Even before the fighting was over, Jerusalem began to be rebuilt as a pagan city. By a strange chance, the foundations of the new city were laid on the usual day of misfortune for the Jews, the 9th of Ab. The Jews were prohibited from coming even near that city. Still once more, we'll go down the pages of history, and we'll come to the year 1492. 1492, and this time the location will change to Spain. The Inquisition has brought a tremendous persecution not only against Christian heretics, but even more so against the Jewish population of Spain. Finally, those that were not killed were, by edict of the emperor, forced out of Spain and forced to leave that country forever. And the date of that edict was the 9th of Ab. Again, quoting from a history of the Jews. August 1st was the date set for the final departure of the Jews from Castile and Aragon. Actually, the last groups left on August 2nd. By another of those strange coincidences of which Jewish history is full, the date was the 9th of Ab, the fast day which recalls the destruction of the first as well as of the second temple. On that same day, August 2 in 1492, three little vessels sailed out of the harbor near Seville, past the ships on which the Jewish exiles were embarking. It was Christopher Columbus, starting on his epoch-making voyage of discovery, and as his ships moved past the others, Columbus notes this fact in his diary. One may well wonder what Columbus may have thought. If it had been revealed to him that he was on the way to discover a new world in which the descendants of those very exiles would find a haven of refuge. As a matter of fact, Columbus' voyage was more closely connected with the expulsion of Jews and with the events leading up to it than he was ready to admit. Columbus' plans were aided by a number of prominent ex-Jews. His ships were completely outfitted by money that was confiscated from the Jews. His sailors were Jews who were being forced out of the land, had been in prison, and were going and fleeing to a more hospitable place in Spain. So the 9th of Ab, all down history, has been a very disastrous day. Almost a day that seems to be the Lord's stamp of marking judgment upon Israel. But our subject deals with just two of these 9th of Ab. The 9th of Ab in A.D. 70, and the 9th of Ab in A.D. 135. The purpose of this discussion, in view of our second volume study, is to see if there are any historical reasons to carry the parallels between the Jewish and Gospel ages beyond the period of A.D. 70 to 73. We're going to make two premises before we get into this investigation. First premise would be that if we can find evidence historically that the destruction of the Jewish chaff, the Jewish nominal system, continued beyond 73, we might expect to find some parallels beyond 1914 to 18. Second premise, if we can find evidence that Christianity was connected with Judaism and was drawing its disciples directly from Judaism after AD 73, then we might find a similar expectation of a harvest of true Christians from nominal Christianity after the period of 1914 to 18. But we'd like to make one statement first. And as we talk about these destructions, and we see the two dates there, 70 and 135, we would like to emphasize that we are not talking about 1980. That's a subject totally in itself. We are not trying to draw any conclusions about that, although there may be some justifiable ones there, but that is not our intention. We are looking at a parallel of events and not a parallel of dates in this discussion. I'd like to emphasize this. Dates too frequently, future dates, and the Bible student movement have been more of a bane than a blessing. Dates can be a blessing. They have provided a blessing in the Bible student movement. The blessing of a sense of urgency to one's consecration. But too frequently, this has been more than overweighed by the problem of our inability to deal with the disappointments that happen when dates do not have their full realization. Start out with the question, what happened in AD 70? About 64 to 66 AD, the forces of Israel had become separated into three basically rival parties. These three groups finally had one purpose in mind, to throw the Romans out of Palestine. And they finally conquered Jerusalem from the Romans. There weren't many of them, There were 23,000 soldiers that were involved. 5,000 of these were mercenaries from Edom. They were just paid soldiers. So the dedicated soldiers that were involved, there was 10,000 led by one Simon Barjora, 6,000 led by John of Gisela, and 2,400 zealots. This was the sage of this war that concerned Jerusalem itself. Now, earlier, this war had raged in the northern parts of Israel, and one of Israel's leading generals in this war was a man that is well known to you by the name of Josephus. Josephus defected to the Romans and became one of their assistants by the time the battle got down to Jerusalem. He's also the historian that gives us the major information on the details of the war of AD 70. It was Josephus who was used by the Romans to try to persuade the Jews who were in Jerusalem to surrender the city without a battle so that the temple could be saved. And he was using it as though this were the request of Titus. At the beginning of the war of AD 68 to 70, the Roman general was a general named Vespasian. But Vespasian, in the course of events by the death of the Roman emperor and the political events that followed, became promoted himself to being emperor of the Roman of the whole empire. And as a result, he put his son, Titus, in charge of the army. Titus used against Jerusalem in AD 70 siege warfare because the earlier attempts at direct battle failed. The Jews won every direct battle that was involved there in the first stages of this war. So he sat back to starve Israel out. And finally, Israel lost the war. The city was destroyed on the 9th of Ab. What did Israel lose in 70? There were several extremely important things that they lost that they never regained. First was the temple. The temple was destroyed, and to this day, it has never been rebuilt. So the first thing we notice in the loss in 70 was the temple, the use of the temple, all that the temple implied about a direct relationship and a direct overruling of their affairs by God. That was gone forever in 70. A second thing that they lost was the ability to offer animal sacrifices. Now, this had a tremendous effect upon the religious life of Israel because their relationship with God, you recall, was determined upon the basis of the Atonement Day sacrifices, putting them in a condition to keep serving the Lord year to year. Even though this was after Christ and this was an abomination, from their aspect, the loss of the sacrifices was an extremely important thing that happened in 70. Third, they lost the priesthood. The last priest, and it's interesting, the name of the last priest of Israel was Phinehas. And you'll see that name back in the unfaithful priest that was there in the time of Eli, one of the sons of Eli, the one that was just born, grandson of Eli, that was just born at the time of Eli's death, was Phinehas. But Phinehas, the last priest of Israel, was killed in the destruction of Israel in AD 70, and you have no more carrying forth of the priesthood following this destruction of Israel. Fourth thing that was lost were not mentioned on there, but Jewish lives. 500,000 people were slaughtered in the aftermath. There was only 23,000 of the army itself, but there was a ransom slaughter of civilians. 500,000. If you want to know how severe that is, I just noticed in the second volume today, when I was leafing through it, on page 353, in the entire period of the Spanish Inquisition, there were only 35,000 people that were burned at the stake. In fact, just counting those that were tortured and not dead, there was only 347,000 total. And that was under 45 inquisitors. Here you had 500,000 that were killed in the AD 70 battle. Another thing that was lost was the government. You might say, well, Israel lost their self-government much earlier. And that's true. But nevertheless, they maintained, at times at least, the appearance of self-government. And again, we would like to have a quote this time from the history of the Jews. Even before the war, the Jews had enjoyed but little political independence. But at least they occasionally had a native king, and they always had the Sanhedrin, which represented the shell of self-government. Now, after AD 70, there could be no more Sanhedrin, because from the point of the view of Rome, there was no longer a Jewish nation. Palestine was to be governed by a military representative of the emperor. The Sanhedrin in Israel was the combination of our Congress and our Supreme Court. And these two rolled into one, you have the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was put out. Israel lost their government in AD 70. And the last thing we want to notice that they lost was a small thing in itself, and yet it's of high symbolical significance, and that was the temple tax. It was customary for the Jews after the dispersion from Babylon, in order to identify with the temple in Jerusalem, to pay the small sum of 2 shekels a year as a tax to show that we are supporting the temple in Jerusalem. But with the temple gone, the tax was obviously discontinued. And again, going to our quote from History of the Jews, worst of all, the Roman government did something which made the Jews ridiculous. An outward symbol of their loyalty to the temple had been the small annual sum which the Jews the world over used to send for its support. Well, it so happened that about the time when the Jewish temple was burned, the Romans began to build a temple to Jupiter in Rome. The Romans now ordered the Jews to send the same sum, not to Jerusalem, but to the temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill of Rome. This was a deliberate insult. The sum involved was petty. The real point was that despite the pride of the Jews and the God of heaven, they had to pay tribute to the Olympian God, who presumably had conquered their God and was entitled to be his heir. So in 70 we find a very complete destruction that takes place in Israel. There is a tremendous loss that happens. But all was not lost. It was a tremendous destruction, and many of their institutions were gone forever. Two things, really, kept the Jews' hopes alive at that time. First, they were still in their land. They were still living on that hill that had been Jerusalem. Over 1 million Jews remained in Palestine after the battle of AD 70. And second, there was a school that was started as a result of the war of AD 70 in the city of Jabna. And this school is interesting because it shows the continuing history that's of significance as we consider the next ninth of Ab. To get the story of this school, we need to go back into Jerusalem during the siege. All of the Jews who were in Jerusalem at this time were not zealots. They were not all down with Rome at all costs. There was a strong peace party that was within Israel in Jerusalem. The head of this peace party was a rabbi by the name of Yohanan ben Zakkai. He was the most prominent rabbi of his day. But now the problem was, he saw the handwriting on the wall. He saw that Jerusalem was going to be taken. And he saw that as a result, the entire Jewish nationality would virtually be lost unless something was done. But he was not in a position to do anything because he was of the peace party. The zealots wouldn't let him go outside of the city because they thought he would go out as a spy to tell their plans to Rome. And so he was trapped within the city, knowing that he'd be killed when the city went down. So he came up with a clever plan. He talked to a few of his disciples, and they put on sackcloth and ashes, and they went wailing through the streets, "Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai is dead. Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai is dead." And they asked permission to bury him. And so the zealots finally gave them permission, and they carried the casket with Rabbi ben Zakkai out of the city down to the burial tombs and opened the casket. Now comes Rabbi ben Zakkai. He hadn't been dead at all. He just used this as a ruse to escape from his own people. When he got out of the city, he went directly to Vespasian, who at that time was the general. Now this was took a lot of nerve because he was a leader of the Jewish people, and Vespasian had vowed to kill all the Jewish people. But because of his bold move in coming directly to Vespasian, Vespasian said, "Well, I'll listen to what he's got to say. Anybody of that courage has either got something on his mind or he's plain crazy." So he asked him, "What is on your mind?" He said, "I have a prophecy to make, and I have a promise to ask." He said, "I predict that you are going to become the next emperor of Rome." Vespasian wasn't even in line for emperorship. That was his prophecy. He said, when you become emperor, will you let me start a school for the Jewish people to continue our culture? Well, Vespasian felt he had nothing to lose. He wasn't going to become emperor anyway, so why not give him his promise? He said, okay. But the events worked out that Vespasian did become emperor, and he granted the promise to the rabbi, and the school was started in Jabna. Now, the importance of this school is something that perhaps may escape us unless we look at what was in the rabbi's mind. He knew that what happened was they had eliminated the government of Israel. And as a result, Israel was going to be completely lost, dispersed among the nations. They had no possible hopes left. But he came up with a way to circumvent this. He said, okay, we can't have a Sanhedrin, but we can have the same thing and not call it a Sanhedrin. And this is what he did. And again, we're going to go back to our quotes from the history of the Jews. The Sanhedrin, which used to meet in Jerusalem, and which was everywhere looked upon as the central legislative and judicial body, could meet no more. Rome had forbidden its revival, as it forbade everything else that pertained to Jewish national life. But quietly, Yohanan ben Zakkai gathered 71 scholars, the exact number that used to sit in the Sanhedrin, organized them under the similar officers, and set them up for the same functions. So you had a government in exile that was formed immediately following AD 70. And then he went through everything else that had been taken. The temple had been taken. So he revised the synagogue services to include all the functions that had been in the temple. The priesthood had been taken. They didn't have anyone of the house of Aaron left to continue the priesthood. So they selected the rabbis that were versed in the priesthood to lead these synagogues and direct them and carry on the same basic functions. You had, in effect, a non-recognized government operating within the midst of an alien country. You see this a lot in political history today, especially in Southeast Asia. It's the same type of thing that often occurs there. But now, let's leave this and let's go and look at the political history of Israel leading up to 135. The revolt that saw the fall of Jerusalem in 70 finally came to its full end in 73, as you read in that Article 5950, when the fortress at Masada fell. And that completely broke the Jews' ability to rebel against Rome at that time. The survivors that were left, and there was over a million of them, they separated into isolated, assimilated groups into all of the major cities. But many of them formed little villages out in the mountains. And there were 125 of these Jewish villages that were formed immediately after 73. They just lived in normal village life. There was no rebellion against Rome, except as there was the maintaining of their heritage through this school that Rabbi Yohanan had founded. Eventually, in the 103 to 105 area, Trajan becomes the emperor of Rome. And he tells the Jews, because you have not rebelled for these years, I'm going to rebuild the temple for you in Jerusalem. The temple was about to be reconstructed in Jerusalem. But then the political pressures of the Samaritans in the area became so strong that Trajan reneged on his promise. And as a result, revolts broke out all through the Jewish Empire, the Roman Empire, by the Jews. Two very big revolts, one in Egypt and one in Cyprus in the year 113 AD. These revolts were put down quite easily by the emperor, although in Cyprus the persecution against the Jews was so severe that every Jew in Cyprus was killed. This completely wiped out the Jewish population of that island. Then Hadrian becomes emperor, and Hadrian renews this promise to rebuild the Temple of Jehovah in Jerusalem. But at this time, and we need to now take up the second line of thought, what happened. At this time, there was something else happening down around the Dead Sea. The head of the school that this Rabbi Yohanan had followed was taken up by a man who was highly respected in Israel, is used today by the Jews, is found in the Talmud, many of his quotations, Rabbi Akiva. At this time, there was in the area of En Gedi, down in the south end of the Dead Sea, a soldier coming on the scene by the name of Bar Kokhba. His name was actually Bar Kosheba, Simon Bar Kosheba, Simon the son of Kosheba. This man had such a tremendous appearance as a warrior, and was so appealed to this Rabbi Akiva, that Rabbi Akiva proclaimed him as the Messiah of Israel. Here was the one that was at last going to deliver Israel. But it was one thing for Rabbi Akiva, prominent as he was, to proclaim this. It was another thing for the people to accept this. So they had to have some sign that the people would accept. So they devised miracles for Bar Kokhba to do. He began to swallow fire, just with a simple device of putting certain kind of wood in his mouth, where he would appear to be breathing fire and swallowing fire. He began doing healings. And as a result, the Jewish people began looking to him as their leader through these wonders that he worked in the land. And finally, he got all of the Jewish communities to pledge allegiance to him. And by this time, those 125 Jewish communities in 70 had grown to 985 communities. And they all proclaimed him as the Messiah. And then he went forth to fight to save Israel. Now, there's not really a lot that was known about Bar Kokhba, as you'll probably notice in your encyclopedias, until 1959, coming up to real modern history. But in 1959, the general of Israel's army, Yigal Yadin, started an expedition to go and to look archaeologically in the area where he lived. And they discovered a tremendous treasure trove of his letters that he had written, titled deeds, and they began to reconstruct exactly what happened under Bar Kokhba, as we'll call him. Because once he became proclaimed the Messiah, his name was changed from Bar Kosheba to Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba means the son of the star. And it was Akiba's reference to the prophecy in Numbers 24:17 by Balaam that a star would rise out of Jacob. He said, this is the star. This is the Messiah that has risen out of Jacob to deliver. That's how they got the name Bar Kokhba. But from these letters we find that the strength of Bar Kokhba's army was 400,000 soldiers. He gathered an army 20 times the size of the army that was used in A.D. 70. The first thing he did was march in Jerusalem, and he captured it, drove the Romans completely out of Jerusalem. Again, we'll go to a quote, this time from the book Bar Kokhba, page 18. The war of Bar Kokhba, or the so-called Second Revolt, was a cruel war, more cruel than the First Revolt of 66 to 70. It lasted over 3 years, with initial success for the Jews, who, led by Bar Kokhba, conquered Jerusalem and re-established the Jewish state, thus endangering the Roman Empire under Hadrian, who was forced to dispatch the best of his legions to Palestine to fight the rebels. But not only did he conquer Jerusalem and re-establish the state of Israel in Jerusalem, he drove the Romans clean out of Palestine. He went that far that they just drove the entire Roman army right out of the whole country of Palestine. This time we'd like to go again to the pictorial history of the Jewish people. Bar Kokhba drove the Roman legions out of the entire country. Some historians believe that had he continued pursuing them, instead of stopping at the Syrian border, he might possibly have roused the entire colonial empire to rebel against Rome. So great was the social turmoil of the time. Bar Kokhba declared the independence of Judea as soon as he had taken over command of the rebel forces. He struck special coins, commemorative shekels and half shekels, with the Hebrew superscription, first year after the liberation of Jerusalem and the redemption of Zion. So immediately he had gone this far. When he conquered Jerusalem, the first thing he did was set up an altar to Jehovah on the Temple Mount and reinstituted the sacrifices to God at that mount. While the victories that they were having were so great that Hadrian did not take it lightly. And so he took the very best general he had, Julius Severus, who was leading the campaign in Britain, brought him down to fight against Bar Kokhba. When Severus came in, he could immediately see that there was no way that he was going to beat the Jews. The Jews were in command. And it's interesting to note again in the pictorial history of the Jews what it says about how Severus fought. Julius Severus was a resourceful soldier. He realized it would be folly for him, as it had been for all other Roman generals, to engage the Jewish army in open battle. Rather, he decided to cut their supplies and starve them out. One by one, he isolated and took by storm the strongholds of the Jews. Bar Kokhba was finally forced to flee to the last rebel stronghold of Bethar. Bethar, by the way, just 7 miles from Jerusalem. For several months, he held out there and managed to inflict great losses on the Romans. Bethar fell in 135, and he with it. Most of the survivors were butchered. Note this. The Talmud mournfully tells that when Bethar fell, the blood of the murdered women and children flowed for a mile like a turgid stream into the sea. This was the greatness of that slaughter that took place at Bethar outside of Jerusalem. This, then, was on the 9th of Ab, 135. And this was a victory that the Romans won, finally. But it was a very costly victory, as can be seen in this quote from Jews' God in History. Of the three Jewish wars, the third one had been the costliest to Rome. When Hadrian reported his conclusion to the Senate, he had to omit his customary ending, "I and my army are well," because neither was well. Hadrian had suffered a tremendous loss of face, and his armies had been decimated, even though he had won the battle. Now, reviewing this part of Bar Kokhba, I've gone into quite a bit of detail. What did Bar Kokhba accomplish? Nine things. First, he restored the government of Israel out of an exile government to an actual working government in the land. Second, he captured the city of Jerusalem. Third, he erected an altar on the temple site and began animal sacrifices once more. Fourth, he was sufficiently in charge to be able to mint coins. And these coins stated the first year after the liberation of Jerusalem. Fifth, he controlled the entire land of Israel and was able to lease and sublease the land. And when he does this, sixth, we'll notice that he observes the complete Sabbath and Jubilee laws in doing it. He leases the land until the Sabbath year. The contracts are specifically spelled out that they find. He goes back to the full institution of the Jewish law upon the place. Seventh, he's able to issue execution orders as a complete judge in charge for those that do not go along. Eighth, he establishes sub-governments, like states and counties, the district of En-Gedi, the district of Herodion, and so on. He has a complete formalized government throughout the entire land. And ninth, and rather interesting, he institutes immediately a persecution of the Christian population. He immediately begins to kill the Christians that were in Israel. I'd like to quote here from the book, The Incredible Christians. They suffered, especially in the persecution initiated by Domitian, and later in the Jewish revolt under Bar Kokhba, because they refused to recognize Bar Kokhba's messianic claims. They wouldn't go along with this, and as a result, Bar Kokhba was death to the Jews, and death to the Christians. And one of the documents they found in Yadin's research was very specific on this. But Bar Kokhba fell. Now, what did Israel lose in 135 when Bar Kokhba fell? First, we want to mention the numbers. The numbers they lost then, the most conservative estimate is 580,000 killed. The estimates go as high as over a million, over double what was lost in 70. 985 villages were razed to the ground. Again, we'll quote from the book Bar Kokhba. 50 fortresses, 985 of the most important settlements were destroyed by the Romans, 580,000 were slaughtered in the many skirmishes, and those who died of hunger, sickness, and fire were innumerable. The whole of Judea was made desolate. So that was the first place. It's like your battles against Israel in 606 B.C. Remember the first time it took many of the Jews captive, but the captivity began when the whole land was desolate. Second thing they lost, got it first on our list here, was the right of access to Jerusalem. From that point on, the Jews could no longer go into Jerusalem. It was off limits, except on one day a year, the 9th of Ab. That was the one day they were permitted to go in to wail over their lost glory and to go to the Wailing Wall. But other than that one day, they were not permitted entrance in Jerusalem. Second, they lost the homeland. They weren't only excluded from Jerusalem, they were driven out of Israel. Almost completely, Israel was depopulated of Jews. Not totally. There were some elements that left the state. But almost complete depopulation. A third thing was a rule was put in by Hadrian prohibiting circumcision. Now this was a very important thing to the Jews because this took away again another mark of their national identity. From that time on it was illegal to circumcise and to bring up a child and as a Jew. A fourth thing, the government in exile that was started by this Rabbi Yohanan was driven out, the school was stopped, and no longer were they able to even have a government in exile. There was no form of government, Jewish government, existing after 135. And the fifth thing, a rather interesting thing to note, was that up to that time, the Christians were regarded by the Christians and the Jews and the Romans as merely a different sect of Judaism. But immediately following 135, they were regarded as a totally different religion. My quote again from the book, Those Incredible Christians. First thing that happened was the first Gentile bishop of the Christian church was appointed in Jerusalem. Obviously, he had to be. The Jews were driven out. And that was Marcus. These events in Jewish history, the Bar Kokhba events, undoubtedly influenced current Christian thinking in two respects. First, they reinforced anti-Judaic thinking among Christians. These now found themselves further confirmed that the Jews had been repudiated by God for the rejection of Christ. And second, they encouraged those who favored a heavenly rather than an earthly kingdom as a reward for believers. Well before the end of the second century, the Christian church had passed beyond its recall to the aims and faith of Jesus and his original followers. Henceforth, from 135, the Jesus of Christianity would become alien to his brethren. It was the end of the Christian efforts to proselyte the Jewish people. That takes us then to the fall of Bar Kokhba and what happened. I might just mention one more recent thing to conclude this part of the discussion, and that is, you know, whenever there's a tragic defeat, that defeat becomes the rallying cry that you go back to try to restore. Remember the Alamo. Remember the Maine. What was the rallying cry of the Zionist movement? Surprisingly, it was remember Bar Kokhba. Here we'd like to quote from Jews, God, and History. On the first Zionist conference, the world at large took little note of the Zionist Congress in Basel. To the world press, it was only a crackpot Jewish organization holding another meeting. Nor did the world note the replica of the Jewish coin used in the days of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, which each member in the Zionist organization received. That was what was sent to each member to enkindle their hopes to go back and reestablish the Jewish state. Okay, what we've noted thus far, then, is that the very most sacred and hallowed symbols of Jewish government under God were destroyed in 70. The temple, the priesthood, animal sacrifices. Then there was a resurgence of sorts through this government in exile until you had the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, out of which there was a total desolation of Israel. No government in exile, no possibility to hold yourself as a nation in any way together, even circumcision being banned. Now what we'd like to notice is some interesting event parallels between what happened in those years and what Scripture prophecy shows us will happen in the time of the end after the Lord's second presence. And remember, when we look at parallels from the Jewish age to the Gospel age, to keep our act here straight, Israel then pictures Christendom. The nominal Jewish house pictures the nominal Christian house. Rome pictures that enemy which tore down Israel, picturing the Lord's great army, the insurrectionists, maybe just to use a basic symbol, the communists, although it includes a much larger group than that, those that will eventually do away with Christendom. And the Christians picture the Christians. They picture the true Christians, those who really are the Lord's. Things we want to notice then, in these event parallels that happened between 70 and 135, and again we'd like to stress we're not drawing date parallels, events only here. First, that the Jews lost their basic political power in AD 70. In 1914, the only date parallel we're going to mention, we find Christendom reaching the end of the lease of the Gentile power. We find the beginning of an expulsion process, even as we found it in Israel in AD 70. But then we find in Israel the formation of a government in exile. Now, not in the capital city, not in control, but a government that still is trying to maintain the appearance of a nation. And we find Christendom still being on the scene. We find Christendom still having its churches, still maintaining an appearance of being there, even though it is in exile from any real power. We find that the Jewish people basically were in isolated, non-adhering villages. One village here, one village there, not connected at all, just as we find Christendom in its isolated churches. We find that finally the isolated villages are drawn together under the charisma of Bar Kokhba. He has to use signs and miracles and wonders in order to impress himself upon them. Just as we notice in Revelation 16, 13 to 16, that there is a union of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet that get together. We see in Revelation 13 that this union is impressed upon others by the signs and wonders which it performs, implying some type of charismatic movement that may be involved in this. We found back there the Christians refused to join up with this rebellion of Bar Kokhba for two reasons, really. First, they were pacifists. Second, they could not admit the claims to messiahship by Bar Kokhba. And so we find the true Christians cannot become involved in Christendom's battle against the Lord's great army, against the atheism and communism that's there, for two reasons. They're pacifists, and they cannot admit to the claims of messiahship by churches. Now, this is not their claim, as the Lord himself who directs the battle. As a result, we find Bar Kokhba persecuting the Christians. As a result here, we find in Revelation 13, 17, a persecution upon those who do not have the mark of the beast or his name or his number. That again, they cannot buy or sell in the spiritual marketplaces. Again, a persecution is there because the true church will not go along with the tactics and the methods used by the false. Next, we find that back there, when Rome was going to put down the army of Bar Kokhba, it could not engage it in open combat. It had to resort to siege tactics. It had to starve them out. And so we find that in the description of the fall of Babylon under the sixth plague, that the device that finally brings you to the brink of the fall is the drying up of the river Euphrates, the withdrawing of all the lines of support, the holding back of the supplies so it cannot be supplied, a similar tactic. And finally, we see that the final defeat of the Bar Kokhba rebellion was not in Jerusalem. It was just outside the city. But the blood from that battle flowed like a river to the horses' bridles for a space of a mile. We find in Revelation 14:21 the description of the treading of the great winepress without the city, that the blood flows to the height of the horses' bridles for 1,400 furlongs. So there are an amazing amount of parallel events between the two. Do these all have to take place by 1980? I said, we're not going to talk about 1980, and we're not. Because no, we don't think they do have to. They could. It's possible. It's humanly possible they could happen. But it's not necessary for the picture. Because the parallels very well, the time parallels, may bring us only to 1914. They may bring us to the beginning of a period of destruction and desolation upon the nominal church. But when you're talking about the nominal Christian church, you're looking at something that's so much bigger than the nominal Jewish house, that destruction period may take longer. We don't know. Time only will let us know whether that goes on. But the events certainly do seem to parallel with the events that we see in prophecy at this end of the age. I would like to finish with two final scriptures. One scripture that will seem to support what we've said, and one that would seem to disagree with what we've said. Isaiah, the 6th chapter, verses 8 to 11, is the first one we'll look at. We find here God's message to the Jewish people throughout the Jewish age, a message that he puts in a very code term for us in this passage. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, here am I, send me. And he said, go tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not. See ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat. Make their ears heavy. Shut their eyes, that they see with their ears and hear with their ears. See with their eyes, hear with their ears. Understand with their heart, and convert and be healed. Now, the fact that this was God's national message to Israel during their period of favor is borne out by the quotation of this in Acts 28, 26 to 28. We won't take the time to go into that. But you notice there that it's immediately says after he gives this message, he said, because you did not listen, therefore I now turn to the Gentiles. Continue in Isaiah 6th chapter. Then said I, Lord, how long? How long will this period go on that you give this message? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. A prophecy that can only refer to the battle of the scope of 135, because you only had one city taken in AD 70. But in 135, with 985 cities taken, with the Jews exiled from the land, so the city is literally without inhabitant, he said, now turn fully to the Gentiles. They began turning to the Gentiles in 36 with Cornelius.